Dance.
If you don't mind.
It's all right. Everyone calls me Dance. Off my mum.
Local broadcaster, musician, TV star, personality. We could go through the list infinitely, but we'll get to that. So could we start with you just giving us a little bit of an introduction for those that don't know you?
Well, I'm a, right now, these days, I'm a radio broadcaster, national radio broadcaster. I've been working for TalkSport now for 20 years. Started as a reporter there in 2004 and became a show presenter and also a commentator. I do more commentaries than anything else there now. Been to several World Cups and European Championships. Also commentated on cricket and darts and things like that. I also currently work for Planet Rock as a presenter of my own show on there, playing sort of classic rock stuff. I started out at BRNB in my broadcasting career.
Yeah,
that is at the back end of the 90s. I was the flying eye. I was the stadium announcer here for about 18 months at Birmingham City, which was an incredibly proud moment as a blue nose to do that job. Yeah. It's been a strange old ride.
Well, normally,
so where I am now,
we feel like we've grown, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
the journalists around Birmingham and VRMB, it's just been our childhood and adulthood, and I think we've kind of
you were the flying eye
journey with us.
You were the flying eye as I left school and into my first job, so literally
right. You're
on the radio every morning.
Yeah,
so we'll get to that. To that. Pace myself.
Yeah, and excited.
Yeah, we can go too far too quick.
So what we normally do when we're talking to people about the jobs that they ended up with and their occupations, it always normally is people leave school, do something, and then they get kind of a yearning that they want to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But you're a little bit different, aren't you, in that you seem to have left school, you've got a job, you're working in retail initially within music.
Mm.
So you've got, your family were all musicians, weren't they?
Yes.
So you were, did you know straight away what you wanted to do?
I had delusions of grandeur from the age of, wasn't quite as early as 10, but certainly by the time I was a teenager, I thought I was going to be a rock star. I have two older brothers, and I grew up, when I was a little lad, they had albums by bands like Thin Lizzy and Deep Purple and Rainbow in the house, and I would listen to those and really like them. And then my brother said, go off and like something. You can't like what we like. I was being the irritating little brother. So I went round to my cousin's house. I would have been 9 or 10 years of age at this point. My cousin lived just around the corner from our house in Solihull. Went round there. I said, can I have a look through your record collection? Flipped through. I found this Kiss album called Kiss Alive, which was a live album from 1975. I took it home. I put it on. And the first five songs on side one, tracks 1 to 5, no exaggeration to say that was a life-changing moment hearing that music. And just, what is this? I love this. The energy, the drive, the sonics of it. And then you look at the band and the glam of it all with the costumes and the makeup and the flash bombs and everything. So I'd have been around 9 or 10 around that time.
So that would have been quite inappropriate as well, wouldn't it? But,
well,
to understand, it's all quite, it's most of Kiss's all based around sex and...
Well, it was, yes, but then as a 9 or 10-year-old, you don't know that. When Paul Stanley sings, put your hand in my pocket, grab onto my rocket, you don't know what he's talking about. You don't. As a 10-year-old, maybe 10-year-olds nowadays are probably a bit more worldly-wise, but I can't say that I was. So by the time I was getting into my teens, I become a drummer at the age of about 10 or 11 as well. And I've been playing piano because my dad, you mentioned, come from a family of musicians. My dad was an incredible piano player, you know, sort of played all sort of lounge stuff and Gershwin and Duke Ellington. He could, you know, anything. He was amazing. So there was a musical sort of genealogy to the dancer family. But I think I decided, right, I'm going to be a rock star. I'm going to get in a band and I'm going to get famous because the music I was into, not just Kiss, but all the other bands, the rock bands I loved around that time, just drew me into the idea of being a touring musician and going out there and making albums and things like that. And so I formed my first band at school didn't really come to much. Then formed another band with a school friend and a guy who's still my best mate to this day, Keith Laurent, who also used to work here as a tannoy announcer. And from the age of, what would that be doing? I was 16, 17. So for the next 10 or 11 years, I was so single-minded about wanting to make it. And so the jobs that I had once I left college were kind of a means to an end, really. Went to Lloyds Bank, first of all. My first job was at Lloyds Bank in Shirley.
Yeah.
Worked there for a year. Then you mentioned retail. I started working for a small music shop in Shirley called Express Music, which was the other end of Shirley High Street from where Lloyds is.
Yeah.
Worked there for a couple of years. And then in the 90s, I got a job at the biggest guitar shop in Europe, Musical Exchanges, because I'd learned how to play guitar by this point as well, by working at the music shop. So I'd become a bit of a multi-instrumentalist. But that was all a means to an end, even working somewhere as big as Musical Exchanges in Snow Hill, which was a fantastic place to work. But
still there now, isn't it?
No, unfortunately, it's not. It's gone.
I thought it was the big one.
There was one called Sound Control that took over from it, it's gone. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore, as a man said in Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
So I had brilliant laughs and networked and met so many brilliant people working in a guitar shop. You can imagine, you're a musician, you want to make it, you're working in a guitar shop. Day after day after day, you're meeting like-minded people, you're breaking bread with people who had exactly the same ambitions that you do, not necessarily the same genre, but they want to make a success of being a musician.
Yeah.
And that drives you on. And I was in a local band here called Shotgun Wedding for about 6 years through to 94. We did well round here, but we never progressed up that rung of the ladder. Then I joined a band who were based in South Wales. I'm still living here. They were called, they eventually called themselves Sons of God. And we did get a record deal with a Birmingham Rares,
I saw that, yeah.
Which didn't come to anything. But
how frustrating was that?
Frustrating in the sense that band, Chuck and Wedding deserved better, and Sons of God deserved way better. I mean, I came into that situation, and the singer and the guitarist in that band were fantastic songwriters. Well, I could write songs pretty well at that point as well. I thought, well, I've hit the motherlode here. I've got really good bunch of musicians who can all write songs. I'm being forced to better myself to get to their level. So when this record label MGL, that was run by Tony Sylvester, who used to have connections to Duran Duran, I think was part of their management team, they offered us a record contract, and we signed it at the Hyatt, actually, cigars and goodness knows what when we celebrated. But the money never came through, and it was just it was like a slow release of a balloon, the sort of the deflation of the dream. And it got to a point of about 1997, mid-1997, when we all had a meeting and we just, it's not happening.
Let's call it a day.
Yeah. And that kind of moment of clarity, alcoholics call it, isn't it? So there's a musician's moment of clarity as well when you get to a certain age in your life. So at that point, I would have been 28, 29 years of age and realizing I'm not going to make it. That dream I had from when I was 11, 12 years of age, it's not going to happen. Now, I wasn't mortified by that because, all right, I hadn't made it, but I had had such fun trying to make it. That it had been such a brilliant path to be on.
Yeah.
And meeting and still being friends with now some wonderful musicians and associates and things like that. Wouldn't change it for the world. But it did mean that at the end of 1997, then, I was a bit of a crossroads as to what I wanted to do with my life. Because by then, I was working as a guitar distributor in the Black Country. I was working for Laney over in Cradley Heath, distributing guitars to shops like the one I used to work at. So it had been a slight change in my working life. And I wasn't enjoying it. It was a very lonely job, actually, compared to the camaraderie you get here working in a guitar shop with loads of other people. It was a bit different. And then, courtesy of Keith, my best friend.
That's where your timeline then.
Everything,
the trajectory.
Suddenly, the handbrake turn occurred in.
So how did that come about? So for the record, so this is, you were doing impressions for friends and family.
Yes.
And then your friend has then sent a tape of you.
Well, no, he didn't even send
or a letter, was it?
He wrote this. So I was still working at Musical Exchanges at the time. So this is early 1997. And Keith Laurent had sent a letter to Tom Ross at BR&B saying, my mate Ian, he does impressions of Trevor Francis and Graham Taylor and Des Lynam and Alan Hansen down the pub. We think he's hilarious. He should be on the radio. And he told me that he only told me that he'd done that once he'd sent the letter. So I've sent the letter to him. I was like, what have you done that for? You silly bugger, you know. And I thought nothing more of it. Until one day I was cleaning the guitar counter at Musical Exchanges, you know, dusting it down. And I remember the Tannoy finger, line four for Ian Danter, line four for Ian Danter is Tom Ross. So
thought we'd won a competition.
No, I thought it was Keith. Putting a voice on, having me at it. So I pick it up and it's like, hello, hello. And it was Tom, because Keith can't do impressions. So I knew it wasn't him. I knew it was Tom. And Tom told me that he'd had this letter. It had interested him. Would I record something for him? So there wasn't an audition as such. I was basically told what he wanted. He wanted a 2-minute maximum sketch involving sort of local topical issues, but using whatever football voices I wanted to go out on the Saturday afternoon show prior to their 3 o'clock kickoff, whatever Capital Gold Extra AM, I think it might still have been at that time, was playing out, whether it was Bluesville or Albion, whatever. So I said, yeah. He said, I can't pay you for it. I said, it's fine, you know, it's something to do. It's just a string to the bow. So I went into the old BR&B studios on Aston Road North the night before it was due to go on air with a script that I'd written at home. Keith came with me as sort of moral support. I met Tom's producer, Guy Jogo, and we just recorded it. And it got played out the next day. So whether Tom heard it in the morning and said, yeah, that's fine, or whether he just said, just play it out, I'm sure of
Lee. There was no margin for error. You just did it.
Yeah, I just knew I had to keep it clean and keep it local and keep it topical and, you know, and keep it to under 2 minutes. So I did that. And 2 weeks later, his producer ran back, can we have another one? And that carried on through to the summer, by which times I had switched jobs to go to Cradley Heath. And of course, you know, June, July, I don't get any phone calls and it kind of drifts out of my mind. August comes, my phone goes at my new job and it's a new producer Tom's got who's saying, we'd like to use you again for sketches. We can pay you this time. And I think that sort of August 97, where it was a little ting, a little bell went off in my head saying, there might be more to this than I'm allowing myself to think about at the moment. And sure enough, we fast forward to February of 98. And again, I'm at my desk at Cradley Heath and the phone rings and it's Tom. He says, Dant, can you come in about half an hour? I said, well, I've got stuff on. I need to see you. Okay. I made up a cock and bull story to my bosses at Laney that I needed to go into the jewellery quarter to pick up guitar parts. Took the works van, drove into Aston Road North, parked up, and Tom met me at reception, took me up to the programming floor, where I've been a couple of times, and walked up to the this door that said program controller, knocked on the door. I was ushered in and met the program controller at BR&B. I'd not met him before that time. His name's Paul Jackson, son of Richard Park, the Fame Academy sort of austere judge. And he basically offered me a job within 5 minutes of me sitting down in a chair like this in his office. He'd offered me the flying eye job.
Why?
Because Tanny Gooding, who was doing it at the time, was going to go to work with Les Ross in the studio on the BR&B breakfast show, like as a double header. So there was a vacancy in the flying eye. And Paul, having heard my sketches, thought I would be the guy. So he's offered me the job there and then. I'm just sitting there thinking, shit.
You've got the world one outside for your current job.
I've got to, yeah, well, the funny thing what you said, I'd like to start next week. going up in the plane with Tammy for her final week and learn the ropes. And then the week after, ostensibly, you're on your own. The funny thing was, that next week, I booked off work. Not to go anywhere, go on holiday, do anything. I just needed to get away from it. So it fell in my lap that I was able to then go up in the plane with Tammy that next week, watch her do what she did from a technical point of view and from a verbal point of view, learn what she was doing and how she did it. I got to do a couple of bulletins on the Friday for Tony Butler's Extra AM breakfast show. Then that was it. The next week, I was in. So the Friday afternoon after my training week, I drove to Laney, gave them the pill, said, sorry, I'm off.
Did they believe you? Did they take that as I'm going from this to I'm going to do this?
Lyndon Laney, who was the head honcho at Laney Amps, he was not happy, but understood, I think, about the opportunity that had suddenly presented itself to me. That didn't mean he was going to be thrilled for me, but I think he understood that, from my perspective, it was a no-brainer. So
he would turn down.
So that next week, my broadcasting career started in earnest.
Wow. It's funny, isn't it, how these things and karma and the universe just finds a way.
Yeah.
So you've spent your whole life trying to do one thing, and then an opportunity that you weren't even looking for taken a completely different direction.
I'd done radio at Sixth Form College and enjoyed it. And we actually had Terry Christian and Radio 4 schools and colleges come to host a show from Sully Hall Sixth Form College. And I met him and, you know, but the producer that day said, if you want to get into radio, you need a degree. And because I was dead set on being a rock star, I had no intention of going to university, no intention of further education. My education, as I saw it, was, you know, the University of Life, you know, get down on the road and get stuck in a transit van with four or five other degenerates and playing to various toilets up and down the country. You know, that was the vision I had in my mind. So, yeah, and then suddenly, yeah, this opportunity presents itself. I remember ringing my mum and dad after I got back to... So I'd been offered this job and I said yes. So I knew that the next week I was going to go back and get to my private little office space, ring my mum and dad. I said, shit, can't believe what I've done here. And dad said, go for it. I know you're unhappy where you are. And that was all I needed to hear. Just that little bit of validation from the old man.
Not to say, oh, it's crazy. And
yeah.
And I take it you were fine with heights. There was no issue with that.
Heights I could deal with to an extent. I mean, you're going up in a twin engine Seneca. Everyone thought it was a helicopter. I think it might have been in the very early days when Charlie Neal did the flying eye. But by the time I was doing it, and by the time Tammy was doing it before me, it was a Seneca twin engined.
Yeah, it's always just because that's the view of it in media and everything, yeah, as well, isn't it? There's someone with the headphones on leaning at the helicopter point.
Yeah, and well, that's Arnie Pie in the Sky. It's the Simpsons, isn't it? You know, so... So on windy days, it was not fun because you would get buffeted around and you would take clients up quite often, advertisers with the station, prize winners sometimes. And sometimes you'd be circling a road traffic accident somewhere on a motorway or major road and they get decidedly queasy in the back. So the sick bags that were provided came in handy on more than the odd occasion. But on the days when it was sunny and there wasn't a cloud in the sky and barely a breath of wind, felt like the best job in the world at the time to do that. So, yeah. But, of course, from that, things developed.
Yeah. Well, the eye in the sky, within 3 years, you were doing drive time. So, obviously,
yeah,
that was a pretty accelerated rise. How did it move so quickly? How did you go from that one to another so quickly?
I mean... A lot of belief in me from Paul Jackson, the BR&B program controller. And he was a hard taskmaster and he wanted the best from me. Because pretty soon after starting doing the Flying Eye, he started offering me cover shifts on Extra AM, doing the Elvis Hour or the Beatles Hour that they used to have. And that was very simple. This is radio just to learn the basics of coming in and coming out of records, reading out requests, reading out, you know, those people having Beatles or Elvis get-togethers, things like that. So you understood the basic structure of how a radio show should sound. And then from that, he tried me out on Sunday evenings on BRNB in mid-98. But again, it was not enough of my personality was coming out. So he stuck me on overnight, Saturday night to Sunday morning. He said, I want you to carte blanche, do what you want. You know what you're doing in The Flying Eye with Les? Do that over the course of 6 hours, midnight till 6 a.m. Bring people in if you want. I'll pay them. It's fine. Just, I want to hear more of you. And
I bet that was great.
That was when the Barmy Brummies came into being as a title. And radio presenters will tell you about this thing called, I don't know whether they do it anymore these days in music radio anyway, but it's called a snoop session, where you would take a blank cassette into the radio studio with you, put it in the machine, and you'd set it to record and pause. Every time you open the microphone fader, do a link, it would go to record and play on the cassette recorder and record your link. When you turn the fader, when you pull the fader down, switch the mic off, and the next record started, it would spool around for another 2 seconds and then go back to record and pause. So effectively, that cassette would just have all your links on there and nothing else.
Oh, okay.
So you'd record that when requested, and at the end of your show, you would then take that cassette, put it in this box, and put it under the door of the program controller for them to listen to the next day.
I got to think it's any tidbits that they can.
Yeah, and snoop sessions were brutal.
Right.
You know, people coming out of there in tears sometimes, you know, because of the way that their whole presenting style was basically cut to ribbons.
Yeah, that's what Dan Kelly had said to us before, wasn't it? It is quite ruthless and quite cutthroat because you're vulnerable in that you're saying, this is what I'm doing. I think this is good, this is funny, but then someone's telling you, it's not all you need to change this.
You know, and you, a similar sort of thing happened when I started getting into the football, working for Tom, that there were certain things that you should, and there were do's and do nots. And you learned very quickly to avoid the do nots. And I snooped the first overnight Barmy Brummies because they'd asked me to. We want to hear what they're, because of course they weren't going to be listening live.
Yeah,
at that hour, at 12:30 on a Saturday night, Sunday morning. So I snooped it, put it under his desk, his door rather, as I left, bleary eyed, first thing Sunday morning. Monday morning, I'd come back from The Flying Eye doing my shift, and my answer machine was beeping. Pressed it, and it was Paul Jackson saying, Dance, it's Paul sitting here with Mark. Mark was the head of music, listening to the show. Brilliant, just what I've been wanting to hear. What, that's exactly what we want from you. More of the same, please. Thanks, bye. That was it. So, again, another little light bulb moment. Okay, let's develop what we did overnight, whether it was just, you know, doing silly voices or gags and things like that. And so the Barmy Brummies quickly, it had a short stint on overnights, but he was so happy with what we were doing. It went in three really weird stages in between, I would say, let me get this right. It's, before you got to between 99 and 2000, we moved from Saturday to Sunday overnights to Saturday early breakfast, so 6 a.m. to 8 a.m., so condensed it down to 2 hours. And then he was so happy with that, the Barmy Brummies then got shifted to Saturday breakfast, 8 till 12. And then from that, he was so happy with that, he took us off weekends and put us on weekdays, early afternoons, 2 till 4. And then by May of 2000, April, May of 2000, that was when we got given drive time, 4 till 7.
Which is absolute prime time.
Absolute prime time. So it was just stages of, okay, that you could feel that because you were moving up in terms of potential audience shares, you were moving up in terms of, you know, what was expected of you.
Did you start feeling the pressure then of the sketches?
Yes, probably more so once we went weekdays, because any show, and you know, some of my radio heroes, people like Mark and Lard on Radio 1, I can, that show just would have ep material, which is why we needed the benchmark items like Mark and Lard had with, you know, Lard's Classic Cuts and Fat Harry White and, you know, things like that, and Down Count and Missing Words. So we needed benchmarks of our own as the Barmy Brummies, and that's where Des's Dedications came from. Black Country Bob, the politically incorrect MP for Dudley. We have the Beckhams as a recurring sketch that was kind of Terry and June piss take. We had the Mr. Men stories, like fake Mr. Men stories read by Arthur Lowe that didn't actually make the cut from the ones that we saw on telly or read in books. And they were important because, you know, yeah, they weren't topical. They weren't necessarily having to be topical.
Yeah.
But there was plenty of topical stuff you had to do. So, yeah, there was immense pressure.
And I assume as well that it's more difficult doing a radio sketch show than a TV sketch show because you've got obviously audio-visual.
No, not really. I love theatre of the mind. Theatre of the mind. So Black Country Bob is this loudmouth MP for Dudley who shouts his mouth off at Tony Blair across the dispatch box at Prime Minister's Question Time. So they can see it in their mind's eye, the listener. They probably picture what they think Black Country Bob looks like.
Yeah.
I wasn't the voice of Black Country Bob. That was Sean Percival, one of my writing partners who came in to work with me. Very funny guy. Still does stand-up. Really funny guy. So he was the voice of Black Country Bob. I was the voice of Blair, and we're firing off little sound effects. And we're recording the sketch as live, and I'm firing off boos and yeah, yes, and things like that. And it was really, I love doing that. That's my favourite sketch that we used to do because it was funny, B, it was challenging, and C, it clearly resonated with the Birmingham public because I was told that that item, Black Country Bob, and Des's Dedications, where Des Lynam reads out a sort of innuendo-strewn dedication to a workplace. I was told that the production line of the Rover stopped. So they stopped the machinery so they could hear what crap Black Country Bob was coming out with this week. So I affected productivity.
You're the reason it's no longer there.
Yeah. I shouldn't be too proud of that, really. But that was the... You understood the power of the particularly independent local radio had at that time, whether it was VRMB in Birmingham, whether it was Capital in London, or, you know, Red Dragon in South Wales, or Trent in Nottingham. That's, you know, they all had that power.
Yeah.
To, you know, really connect with an audience.
At that time, I was reading on your bio with Des, because I remember Des, but you were singing at Alexander Stadium in front of 30,000 people, a parody of Craig David's Seven Days.
That is the most voice. Bizarre thing ever. So very early on in the Des's Dedications thing, Andy Robinson, another of my fellow, another brilliant stand-up comic, came up with this idea that Des Lynam was chasing after an unnamed female within, you know, his sphere. And he was going to... we came up with the idea of him because we had a backing track of 7 days lying around. This was in the very early days of you know, solo artists and bands having CD backing tracks that they would come into the studio and sing live over. So there was this backing track of 7 days lying around. Andy comes back with this idea that Des sleeps with this girl and ends up, you know, opposite Monday, took over a drink on Tuesday. We were making love by Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Nasty rash on Monday. Went to the clinic on the Tuesday, antibiotics on the Wednesday, and Thursday and Friday and Saturday cleared up on Sunday. And again, boy, oh boy, did that hit home with the BR&B listeners. To the extent that I was asked by the programme controller at the next party in the park we did at Alexander Stadium to put on a Des Lynam wig and go out there in front of 30,000 people and do what I and sing that song in front of And I got a wild round of applause. It was just, I mean, you know, I'd spent years before, all the years playing all the toilets up and down the UK, thrashing around on my drums and, you know, never thinking, here I am putting on a blonde wig and a moustache. A bit fantastic. And suddenly you're finally getting the
recognition.
It's acceptance, you know, for doing something as daft as that. So, yeah, again, you understood the power of what a good sketch or a good character or good local radio can do. It just...
Because at that time...
It makes people laugh.
Yourself, Les Ross, Jezza.
Yes.
I mean, this was the time... This was around the time with Two Strangers wedding, wasn't it? And
you had...
And it was national news, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Everything was national news at the time, right?
The BR&B had their highest ever reach, you know, percentage of audience share. Around that time, because yes, you had Les Ross in the morning, Graham Mack doing his brilliant comedy stuff, sort of 9 till 12. Then you had Ricardo, 96.4 minutes of music without any ads. Then it was me. Then it was Scott Hughes with his, you know, pop star guests and film reviews. Then Jeremy Kyle, Jezza, Late Live, which became Jezza's Confessions at 10 p.m. I mean, it was a real heavyweight lineup of personality radio.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it put, the personalities everywhere. And it was an absolute privilege to be a part of. And because of the route, the unorthodox route I had taken, certainly compared to anybody else, there were times when do I deserve this? I feel a little bit fraudulent that I just sort of almost been fast-tracked into this position of being the drive time presenter, you know, over and above certain others who might have argued they deserved that role.
I was going to say, did you find as you became more successful and it became more popular, did you find then these other pressures within the station and around the roles that you're obviously doing?
The only pressure was the pressure you put upon yourself, generally speaking, to make sure that the content of what you did was funny and hit home. And the only thing I had, because Paul Jackson left and another program controller came in and he wanted me to do more funny phone calls. I never liked doing funny phone calls. So we butted heads about that a lot. I was much happier doing the sketches and the parody songs that we used to do. That's me being creative in the way I enjoy it, particularly the parody songs, which I still do to this day on Planet Rock. But yeah, there were certain aspects I didn't want to do, which I felt I was being railroaded into doing, and I fought against that. Mm. But generally speaking, you policed yourself. But I've got every sketch and song we ever did on mini discs stored somewhere in the back cave.
A bit like the Beatles memorabilia. And
yeah, they shall never be heard. They shall never be heard, because there's probably so much stuff on there that if I was to play out in 2024...
is it like the time capsule there?
I think it is. I think there's just...
Put that back in.
Yeah, that can stay where it is. There might be a certain element, not constant, but just occasionally, blimey, went a bit far there.
It was a different time, wasn't it? This is a whole contradiction, isn't it, with what we're looking at now. And we live in a very woken aware society, don't we? And the rules don't apply or can't apply to things that happened 20 years ago in comedy. Comedy especially, isn't it? It's been absolutely... Yeah.
So the parody songs I do now, we're very careful about how we approach the lyrical content.
Very not Planet Rock, you've got to...
Yeah, and the bosses have to approve it before it goes on air, so... I record it, I send it to them, and only once or twice have they said, I'm not sure about that.
Your face. Yes.
And I've changed it or abandoned it.
So what are the differences now with Planet Rock as opposed to what BR&B was like back in the day?
Well, obviously it's a national music radio station and it's playing the music I love. You know, BR&B did play stuff that I liked, but it played a lot of stuff that was from genres that I didn't really follow. But that wasn't a problem. It's funny when I hear songs played at football stadium now, if I hear Lady by Mojo or Music Sounds Better With You by Stardust, does it?
90 Hours.
Yeah, that gives me a nice warm, fuzzy feeling about going back to those days at, you know, at BR&B and playing those songs and knowing how popular they were. Feel So Good, Sonic. Oh my God, if I hear that song again, it won't be too soon. Looking for Love, Karen Ramirez. I knew it was about 10 to 6 in the morning when I was playing that because it just seemed to be scheduled for that sort of time.
Yeah.
So there are songs that,
yeah, it's the Cause and the Robbie Williams song from the time as well. They were playing constantly for
Let Me Entertain You and She's
for the wedding for the, yeah, the two strangers.
But all radio was doing that at the time. There were big songs. Back for Good was probably the first example I can think of, or Torn by Natalie Imbruglia, where all radio stations hammered those songs. It was played on the hour every 3 hours, maybe even every two, I don't know, but certainly it was hammered.
Yeah.
Because it was a popular song. But yeah, for Planet Rock these days, the music that I play is 98% of which is on my, you know, on my phone, on my playlist or whatever it may be. And I'm speaking to an audience that I relate to because I meet them at gigs and I meet them at festivals that I work at for Planet Rock. So it's a very comfortable working environment for me. They do try and make sure, unless you're doing an hour from a specific year, like the Planet Rock years at 9 o'clock every morning that Paul does, you won't, you'll maybe start with a song from the 70s. You won't play a 70s song second. You'll go to a different decade, go to the 90s or there's at least two or three current songs an hour from, you know, the current A and B playlist that they have. So there is a science to it.
Isn't there a rule as well that you don't play a female artist and a band or a...
No, I don't think that... I know I've played, you know, Heart and Stevie Nicks back to back. I'm sure I have in things like that. Yeah, that doesn't happen to me. Yeah, that definitely... that. Well, it's certainly a Planet Rock myth. Whether that applies to Capital or other radio stations, I don't know. But no, Planet Rock is, you know, there's a structure to it, but it at least allows me to be creative with the parody songs that I've put together because it gives my show a unique selling point and the listeners seem to enjoy it. And sometimes I come up with a parody song too that I thought, oh, I've done all right there. I did one for Marillion. Fish was selling his gaff in the West Highlands or something. So I did a version of Lavender, all about the lavatories, you know, because he's a technician on the tour of the house. And I didn't realise I could sing vaguely like Fish. Vaguely. Enough to make it sound funny.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Have you ever dropped one that you thought was absolutely banged on the money and it fell flat?
Ooh.
Or the other way, where you're like, and then it's just gone mental.
Sometimes you're not. Well, I mean, back in the day on BR&B, there was a story about a blaze at a Centre Parks. Nobody was injured. So, right. So we did, and I had to put it all together with the drum machine and guitar and bass, bouncing track. We had to do a version of Blur's Part Life, and it was Centre Park Fire. I get up when I want, except yesterday morning when I was awoken by a raging inferno. Centre Park Fire. So this is about the year 2000. All the people, so many people, they all go, ah! But, you know, I had to stress before I played out, nobody was, but it was just a fire that had to be contained at a centre park somewhere. And I thought, when I was putting this is going to get me in so much trouble. And it didn't. It actually went down really well with the listeners.
That's brilliant. How many listeners have you got now, Planet Rock?
Oh, over a million listeners per week to Planet Rock. It's one of the biggest digital only stations.
Why?
You know, doesn't have an FM frequency. It did have one around here, 105.2, for a little while, going back 10 years or so maybe. But no, as a digital station, it's got, you know, it's 25 years old next month. And it's, you know, still going very, very strong.
Excellent.
Which is great. It's amazing to be a part of it because I'll
do it remotely.
Yes, yeah. You can. They do have studios down in London, but you can work from home and record remotely. Yeah, yeah.
Have you got a home studio as well? Is that where you record your?
Yes, I've got. We put parody songs together there, and yeah, guitars and electronic drum kit and things like that, and I could do myself. I'm self-sufficient in that regard, yeah.
Okay. So, radio, unbelievable success. You then transitioned to TV.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, I was released from BRMV in the summer of 2002. I wasn't expecting it. They had a complete, that program controller who came in, who I mentioned, who disagreed with about funny phone calls. He was making a lot of changes. Graham Mack had gone. I went not long after Les went. It was a complete change from personality radio to more music. They basically just wanted to get more songs away,
yeah,
per hour. I was one of the victims of that. So I was very much at a loose end. Although I was, by that time, established as a football commentator working for Tom Ross for Capital Golf, which, yeah, name changed from Extra AM. So I kept my hand in there, but I was looking for something else to do. And that's where a guy called Steve Bennett came in, who was a massive fan of the Barbie Brummies, who was launching a shopping channel in Redditch. And
so how did that come about? He just wrote, his fellow
board members, Debbie Cavill, used to be the lady that relayed me information when I was in the Flying Eye.
Right.
To say, you need to go here to check. So we had a friendship.
She became presenter of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she became part of the presenting team of this this shopping telly channel, which went through a number of different names before it settled on a format called Snatch It, which was like a reverse auction channel, which was very, very successful. And the whole ethos of this TV station that I joined was irreverence and, you know, having a lot of fun with it, all rather than being, you know, stiff bats and QVC and, yeah, you know,
destructive.
Yeah, disruptive, slightly anarchic, but still, you know, call to action. Or this is what's on, this is what the price point is, blah, blah, blah. And it took off. It really took off, and there were seven or eight of us who were on shift work. So, yeah, it was a mad, mad time. And then from that, a guy came in one day who was a gemstone dealer from Thailand, American guy or Canadian, forgive me, I can't remember. But he came in to meet Steve. So this is early 2004. And from that one meeting that you had, suddenly the whole ethos of the station changed. It was now going to become a jewellery channel, Gems TV, which is still going now. It's 20 years old this month.
Yeah, because I heard in your information, you went out there, didn't you?
Yeah, I went out to Thailand and we did a training course. All the presenters, and there were quite a few by this time, a good, you know, 14, 15 presenters who worked on different shifts, learning about gemstones and learning about, you know, mining and, you know, cutting of gemstones and gold, silver.
Product knowledge.
Product knowledge, absolutely. So you would then come back from that training course and be ready to be knowledgeable. Then the channel became a little bit more austere, still a little room for fun, but the wild days of, you know, karaoke machines and...
Yeah, and as the gems got more expensive, we got...
Electric scooters were, you know, that was gone. It was basically gems. But again, it proved wildly successful, proven by the fact that it's still going now. I probably worked about 5 years of those studios in between the various different formats that were tried. Yeah, loved it. Another string to the bow, I suppose you could say.
How was that as a transition going in front of the camera from behind a marker in a studio?
Oh, that didn't bother me.
No.
That didn't bother me, really. I do have a face for radio, but I wasn't fussed about being on camera. I didn't feel particularly self-conscious. And when you're working in an environment like that where it's just anarchy,
yeah,
all your inhibitions will drop away immediately, or they'll get even worse and you're not going to last. So,
yeah. Well, we spoke off ahead of me, then Drew and Lucy, and
yes,
I all kind of have done some work with them in the past.
Well, a lot of these people, Drew and Lucy Teo,
just the speeds, and they're born entertainers.
Yeah, aren't they? And they've worked in like an acting drama company called Crag Rats and things like that. They used to go around schools and, you know, perform plays. Oh, yeah. So they have this incredible self-confidence to perform.
I bet that's infectious, then.
Yeah, and that was taken into the selling job, because I had been a salesman not 5-6 years before selling guitars, so I knew how to sell to people. And one of the basic premises of sales is people buy things from people they like and they can empathize with and, you know, like speaking to or hearing from. So everybody that was involved in Snatch It or then Gems TV was, I thought, you know, a likable, friendly, approachable person. And the sales figures proved that, you know, we were likable and, you know, we were offering something that the public wanted to, you know, to delve into and buy. But no, I had no problems going in front of a camera in particularly.
Do you remember the information regarding the Gems and the Jewels?
If you ask me what, I mean, September's birthday, Sapphire, you know, I can still remember certain things, but it's like French. It's like we do French at O-level, and then you go to France 10 years later, it's all gone.
Bits.
Yeah, bits. Just little bits. But I suppose if you stood me in front of a camera there now at Gems TV and said, sell that tourmaline bracelet, I'd probably muddle my way through it. Get some of the way there. Not completely, but it's a different skill set.
Yeah.
To what I'd done before, and it was a valuable skill set to learn, definitely.
Have you ever been offered other TV since?
Nope. No, I've always been...
I suppose radio, there's nothing... So Birmingham Live, just digressing slightly, Birmingham Live and stuff isn't here anymore and stuff like that, but I think you probably...
I was there when that was launched. I remember when that
started. Agonated.
Topless
Darts.
Oh, yeah, live TV, yeah. Well, I remember being approached by them. I went in there and I did a couple of bits with them, but no more than a couple of bits. There was never any sort of...
Peaky Blinders?
Well, I'd go in there as a consultant on the Birmingham accents, I think.
Yeah. It does need it in parts.
One or two.
Yeah.
One or two, but then they'll say that the Birmingham accent sounded like that in the 1920s, so... Who am I? I wasn't around at that time, so... Okay, I'd ask my granddad, but he's not here to ask, so, you know, there we go.
Down here at St Andrews, Knighthead Park at St Andrews, it would be remiss not to discuss the club currently. Within your bio as well, you mentioned commentating and interviewing Trevor Francis. Sir Trevor Francis.
Yes.
As one of your first actual... was it post-match, pre-match?
Pre-match.
Oh, were you getting the nod on the team?
I was getting the nod on the team. So I've been working for Tom for a little while, BRNB Capital Gold at that time. And he sent me to Bristol Rovers for a League Cup tie, Bristol Rovers against Blues. And he said,
Trevor will give you the team. Go to the tunnel and ask for him and he'll come out to you. Okay, all right.
I'll ask. This is my first hero, you know. I've got a blue shirt on underneath this, which has got the number 8 on the back, the old penguin strip.
Beautiful, beautiful strip.
And I've just Trev's number. So I do as I'm told. I get set up in the stand. I go down to the tunnel of Bristol Rovers. So could you let Trevor Francis know that Capra Gold is here? And he comes out and I go interview him. I get the steal on the team. I finish the interview. With my cassette recorder, thank you Trevor, speech after the game, and I'll switch to cassette player, and he just went 8 out of 10, very good, and turned around and walked back down the tunnel. He was marking me out of 10 for my interviewing style, because I think he'd probably been tipped off by Tom. There's a cub reporter coming down to
there's a rookie
rookies yeah try yeah being, I don't you know don't throw him under the bus, don't cuss to pie. So that was my first thing I did was ring my dad. I've just spoke to Trevor bloody Francis, because you know, my dad was a blue nose, my granddad, my great uncle Jack used to work here, Jack the Hat, Jack Danta. He was did all sorts of menial duties around the stadium until he was in his 70s, you know, from sweeping the terraces to helping with the turnstiles and everything. So the Dantas had a real connection to Birmingham City. So to come back here in any role, whether it was to do the stadium announcing that I did here at the end of the 90s, or to come back here as a commentator, as I still do now, for Talk Sport, it's not lost on me how fortunate I am to get to do that. Because, yeah, I love this place. How could I not? I first came here when I was 6, I think. We got beat 2-0 by Stoke on a cold December afternoon. Jimmy Greenoff scored, having not long been with us, gone to Stoke. So my first game here, I was taught you know, this is what Birmingham City will do to you. Ex-players will come back and haunt you, you know. So it was the perfect indoctrination into life as a...
Joys and sorrows.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Well, mostly sorrows, right? But there's been a few joys.
Well, it seems like so with everything going on down here now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, reading on your bio, your thoughts on Trev and how long it took and how close we were so many times when he was manager.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd like to think that obviously before he passed, he took credit in the team that went up. And I know that there was saying around the club that the Trods, mate, after the Chinese ownership, the Trods kind of built bridges and get him involved, hadn't they? But they hadn't been able to do that before he passed. So you'd like to think that before he went, he knew what the club, the people around the club, what he meant to them.
I hope that he knew the day we got promoted at Cardiff, what part he played. I hope he knew that day, and I hope that somebody, it could have been Steve Bruce, might have called, but I mean, he came back here 3 years after that, Martin Granger's testimonial. I played them, got 20 minutes that night, and Trevor passed me the ball. You know. But I'm sure I said to him that night, you know, in all seriousness, I hope you understand what me and all right-minded blue noses think, that there's a big part of us getting into the Premier League was down to the groundwork that you did from, you know, 96 to 2001. It shouldn't be forgotten. But Trevor was not one for taking compliments particularly. He was a very shy man.
Yeah.
Quite introverted in a lot of ways. So you didn't go overboard with the praise.
Yeah.
But it's obvious how much this club meant to him. And it shouldn't do, in theory, because he's a Devonian. You know, he's a Plymouth boy.
Yeah,
yeah.
This club just gets under your skin.
A story I heard, it was Nicky Eden on podcast, and he said at times at the training ground, he was practising free kicks afterwards, because Nicky Eden had a decent free kick on him, didn't he? They had the dummies there, and he's trying to get it up and over, and he's standing there after, and he said Trevor just turned up, and he went, just do it like this. And he's just whipped one straight in the top bins. And he's gone, yeah, just do it all that. Meeting's gone, gaffer, if I could do it all that, I wouldn't be a fucking blues.
I'll tell you a funny story about Trev. He was the one that introduced the Tamperer as the...
Well, oh, yeah.
He gave that CD to me to play because his son James had bought it and liked it and suggested the players should run out of that. So Trev gave me the CD single to play out, and I ended up making a loop of it, so that clapping thing at the start kept going for longer, so it'll have players to come out from the tunnel in the corner and, you know, make it all the way, because in the original version, the vocal cuts in too soon.
Yeah.
Because
I did it right before a wedding. We've all taped, and
it's a excellent
wedding breakfast to it, and I had to edit it a little bit longer.
The artist was local, wasn't she? That she was someone's brother or sister.
Something like that.
In Marston Green.
Yeah. So that was his first idea, which is still used.
Iconic, yeah.
His next idea was based on something the Bolton Wanderers used to do. You might remember when they scored at the Reebok, as it was known then, they used to play Jay Brown, I Feel Good. Yeah. After every goal, didn't you?
Yeah.
Wow, I Feel Good. And the punter used to do all that. Yeah. And Trevor came to me and said, I want something similar but different. Can you come to West Hills next week and chat to the first team squad members about what song they would like played for them when they score, like individual goal music? I thought, well, that's interesting. Okay, so the next week I went to West Hills as the players were having lunch, walked in. First player I walked up to was Martin Granger. And so I introduced myself as on the stadium announcer, where Trevor's got this on a deer, individual goal music. You had your own individual goal, what song would you pick? And without a hesitation, he just looked up at me deadpan and went, please release me. Humperdinck. And I thought at that moment, this isn't going to work. They're not going to take this seriously.
Smack my bitch up.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got, they're all laughing around the table, you know. They're all...
Would they get an inside as to why you were coming in?
No. That's Marty just thinking straight away, please release me, let me go. So I went to Trevor, said, this isn't going to work. It's just not going to buy it. So that fell by the wayside, unfortunately.
But you haven't got a celebration of music as general, or no?
No, they're sponsored, isn't it? And any goal that's scored here, goal scored by number, 11, whoever, sponsored by the Easy Group.
Yeah, who?
That was a who thing. That was something that I inadvertently created. I didn't mean to create it, but I did.
Oh, was that, yeah? Was that your...
Well, the who thing was about, for those that don't know, so when I was doing the stadium announcing, when substitutions occurred, I wanted the player coming off for Birmingham and the player coming on to know that they were being appreciated either for what they'd done or what hopefully they were going to do. So I would leave a gap. So I would say, substitution for Birmingham City, replacing number 9, Dele Adebola. Pause. And that would mean round of applause from around the stadium for what he'd done. Coming on number 11, Peter Unlove. And he'd get a round of applause. Now, just because of muscle memory, I started doing the same for the opposition teams as well. And the Blues fans, being the devilish, rogues that they are, only in little pockets at first, started going, who? When I would say, coming off for Barnsley, number 7, David Flitcroft, who? Number 11, McPherson face, yeah. Who? And then it grew and grew and grew.
It's the way you put the doubt.
Yes. The best ever was when Newcastle came here in the League Cup. Bobby Robson's Newcastle United. They had a man. Shea Given got sent off, I think. Goalkeeper. Yeah. Percy scored. And we were 2-0 up. Shearer was playing. It was about an hour gone. And in those days, the substitute wasn't on the LED board. It was on the cards. I remember, And Rob Shannon, Blues fan legend, sat beside me in the commentary box. He suddenly digs me. Hey, they're getting number 9 ready. Shearer's coming off. And oh my God, what a moment is this going to be? So I press the microphone, the approach, so play stops. It's clear that this, is coming off. Substitution for Newcastle United. And I swear to you, so I'm down there in the commentary box in between the little banks of dugout seats. All around the ground, it was shh, shh. They wanted complete silence to set up for this moment. And I just waited till the... Replacing number 9, Alan Shearer. 26-odd thousand blue noses all did that. I can't remember who came on for him, but he'd have got the... But they lived for that little moment, the Blues fans.
Oh, yeah.
So that's something I inadvertently created and the Blues fans ran with like crazy.
So now I don't know if you know who the announcer is now, but he really pours it on, doesn't he?
He went away for a while.
Yeah, well, Keith Laurent, who when I started getting more and more work with Capital Goal as a football reporter, I had to leave this job behind. So Keith Laurent, my best mate, took over. And he once got in trouble when Bolton were here, because he said, replacing number 10, Idiger Johnson, who? Number 12, Bo Hansen, who? I said, Hansen. So he got in trouble for that. And even when I was doing it, we were told that there were clubs that took issue with...
Oh, really?
The way you were saying
it. The way I was saying it. But...
Yeah, I remember there seemed to be a tipping point. It got so far and then it got really rude and it becomes such a comical thing. But then it flattened out a little bit. So you've actually got... Do you get carpeted and...
I never got told not to do it.
No.
I just knew that there had been complaints that had come in from other clubs. But as far as the club are concerned, let them complain.
Yeah, because you spoke to Marcus Painter a couple of weeks ago, didn't you? And he played when he marked Ronaldo at the game and he got subbed there. So you've had a... That was... I've seen that on Twitter and that as well, where only Blues fans could say Cristiano Ronaldo, who?
Who? Yeah, brilliant. I mean, I love that. That's just so cockeyed.
Blues fans are so fast sometimes, aren't they?
Well, football fans in general are, but I mean, we've got some of the quickest witted supporters, I think. And that might be down to the years of torment,
humour, isn't it?
Yeah.
It promotes that gallows humour and just means that some Blues fans are so quick off the mark. So you just have to tip the hat sometimes. You go, fair play, lads.
Well, it was the Wrexham guy, man. He was, you can shove your Deadpool.
Well, they were doing that. Apparently, Keith told me there were people walking back under the Bordesley Bridge, and a bus went past with the Deadpool Wolverine advert on the side, and they were all crowded round this bus. Yeah, I can see you walking Deadpool up your arse. And this poor bus driver, probably, you know, do it on the 50 or whatever whatever route he's doing. He's suddenly surrounded. No idea why. Why are you singing that at me?
Has no idea.
They can't explain to his wife like what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. They started singing to me about Deadpool. He didn't know what necessarily know what advert was on the side of his bus. But there we go. Yeah.
What's your favourite moment then, Blues? It's not on the questions.
Favourite moment?
Yeah.
Oh, it's got to be 2011.
Yeah.
The League Cup win's got to be up there. I mean, there's been nights here that have been pretty special. The semi-final against Ipswich.
For me personally, that's my standout.
West Ham as well.
West Ham in the semi-final, the comeback. I can also think back further to when this stand had long been built, when Brentford came here, the promotion season from what is now League One, 94-95, we had to beat Brentford. We just won the auto windscreens. And there was a bumper crowd in here that night. And Kevin Francis and Liam Daish scored. And from the stadium shake. The Enkerman game here against the Villa.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was in the Tilton that night. And I've never felt. No wonder ended up with structural problems. Because that stand literally shook that night when Morrison opened the scoring. Yeah. So, yeah. For all that we do the gallows humour stuff, you know. There's been more than enough glorious moments down here that, you know, you can just smile about.
I could call you
there for that. How lucky was I to be there for that?
Still, so the highlights in that Martins, the split second when it drops, you just can hear a pin drop.
Yes, anything could have happened. Floodlight failure.
It still gives me a bit of...
Could have been a floodlight failure, you know. Thermonuclear war could have started. Would have been typical Blues for something to stopped us winning it, or you just ballooned it over the bar, I suppose. But no. He goes and sticks it in the back of the net.
Immense. Yeah.
Still the best joke in history, isn't it? A Frenchman walks into a pole and Birmingham seat in the League Cup. Thank you, Wojciech Szczesny and Lauren Koscielny.
It's the little slap he got round the back of the egg for his troubles.
Oh, yeah. Was that Barry Ferguson? Yeah. Just what he needed.
Yeah.
I've got to ask, what's your favourite impression? And can we have one?
Oh, God.
I was listening to on the site before you came in.
Yes,
listening to Des, Heather Mills song.
Oh, Heather McCartney.
Heather Mills.
Well, in a rugby. Yeah,
it's like cultural moments in time, isn't it? When you look back on, because you pick moments and you look back. Oh, I remember that. I remember that was a thing in the news.
It's like naked baby photos for me. Some of those sketches and songs and things. I'm like, oh God, where was my mind at when that?
Did you ever go too far with the Des Larnhams in kind of?
No, we never got never a complaint upheld about Des. We once did go too far with Black Country Bop. I shan't say why, but we did go too far and acknowledge it and apologise for it. But that was in our Heart FM days. So in all the time that we were on BRMB, never one complaint upheld. But Des's dedications was no different really to Julian and Sandy that Kenneth Williamson had been doing on Radio 4 years before. Or indeed Fat Harry White that Mark and Lab are doing. It was just a similar furrow to that. Favourite impression? Well, I mean, if we're talking now, I suppose my Jim Way is probably up there. You're working with him at Talk Sport. Breaking news here, Natalie, this is huge. Not only is it huge, it's massive. Thomas Tuchel is becoming the England manager. You know, that's enormous news. You know, everything becomes, you know,
completely. You do that too? So I'll do that for him.
I've done it. I'm not sure I've done it to his face. No. No.
I think you definitely need to tie a Simon Jordan into that then as well.
If I could do a Simon Jordan, then I'd be well away. But that's work in progress. Yeah. And I'm not prepared to display that work in progress right now.
No drafts.
Yeah. No.
And again, I know we're going to wrap up, but. What are your thoughts on Thomas Tuchel as an appointment?
We're after success, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm fairly underwhelmed to it. I don't understand the confected outrage. Mm. It's like Sven and Fabio Capello never happened. the way I've heard some of it framed.
Well, one of our pals, he'd oh, I can't believe you, we've got a German manager. Then one of our other pals, but you wanted Klopp. Yeah, no, but that's different.
You see, you become anglicised in people's minds after a time that sort of permits that.
Yeah. Because we wanted to be Klinsmann back in the day as well, weren't we, during that time?
And that would have been a similar thing to Klopp. I think the fact that he'd spent time here and was a very personable character.
Yeah.
I think Tuchel has this perception that he's quite abrasive, and that might work against him. But I think the accusation is that he doesn't manage up very well, but doesn't really have to worry about that as an England manager. All he's got to worry about is picking the right 23 players for a squad and formulating a team and tactics, you know, around that. So
Carsley evidently didn't want it.
No, but then he didn't. I think the glare of the spotlight is not. He really isn't that guy. I mean, you know, there was talk of him even coming here and
whatnot,
but I don't think he ever really entertained being anything more than a caretaker. I think he enjoys, genuinely enjoys being behind the scenes and the graft and everything that being an under-21s manager allows you to do without that being in that goldfish bowl.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the fact that he said in the interview of, yeah, I made a joke, I tried it. We haven't won anything since 66, so I tried it. I'd do it again. I'd do it again in a heartbeat, same thing.
Yeah.
Try a different system. And that's, yeah, it doesn't seem like the confidence, some of these, Joe, I've been a journalist yourself. Do you find that there's sometimes these certain styles of journalists who just want to poke a bear and get that
reaction
at any cost rather than have an adult conversation?
They call them the professionally offended, don't they? And unfortunately, there's too much of that in our media nowadays. Confected outrage, professionally offended commentators, not just in sport, but in politics and you know, current affairs and things like that. There is a desperation to find offence. There is a desperation to, you know, be politically partisan to the point at which it's quite embarrassing at times. Unfortunately, I don't think we're ever going to lose that. It might get lessened slightly, but it's here. And it works, it seems, for some sections of the population who gorge on that sort of confected outrage.
It was some kind of in COVID, wasn't it, where there were certain people that enjoyed the isolation, phoning police, there's someone outside, the neighbours snooping on neighbours, grassing neighbours up because they liked being so, being away, they don't want to see other people out. It's created a really weird kind of psychological
rewiring of people's brains. Well, 4 years on from COVID and the lockdowns, and I think it's going to take a long while for the after effects of that from society's point of view to sort of ease off and be less and less of a factor. You've still got people that are poorly with long COVID. You know, there's all sorts of strands that have come out of this pandemic. Social problems, mental health problems, you know, long-term health issues, what it's meant for what we think of our government and how we think we're being run. There's so many threads to it all.
One of the threads being that you read Steve Bruce's crime novel.
Well,
Steve Bruce's... Yeah,
this was just because TalkSport would look desperate for content when lockdown had hit. And I'd actually started doing a Barmy Old podcast thing, digging out those mini discs that I mentioned earlier with old Barnley Brubbies and Heart FM sketches on there, and playing them out whilst eventually writing some new stuff. And Paul Hawksby of Hawksby and Jacobs, the TalkSport afternoon show, heard this one sketch I put out where I was doing a Steve Bruce impression. He said, look, we've got this idea. Steve Bruce genuinely wrote murder mystery novels in the late 90s. There's barely any copies anywhere. I've got a copy of the first book courtesy of our colleague Martin Kellner. We wondered whether you could read it out in the style of Steve Bruce for some content, so it sort of kills 5 minutes every day. So this book, Striker, all about this manager, Steve Barnes, who's the manager at Lettersford Town, some nondescript town somewhere near the M62. you know, has to solve a murder mystery where one of his players is found with a knife in his back.
I remember this book coming out. I remember it being in the Sun. I won a competition here with Dan Kelly in the in the Jasper. That was one of the questions. Who and yeah, I was like, what? No one knows that Steve Bruce wrote these books.
Even at three.
Yeah, it was in the Sun at the time. It was like national news.
So bizarre.
So, I started reading it, and as time went on, I started putting little in jokes in there, in amongst what had genuinely been written. There's a whole 2-page section where he goes, genuinely writes about how brilliant his Jaguar is. And it's clearly Steve Bruce was after a nice deal from his Jaguar dealership. The way he said, and honestly, it was like reading Top Gear, a feature review of a Jaguar XJ or whatever it was he was driving. So, of course, you're reading that, you're having some fun with it, and you put some extra little bits in. So, you know, that was, there was talk, because as we got towards the end of the book, we were sort of coming out of the first lockdown, but we couldn't not finish it, you know. There was talk that Steve could have read the last chapter for us had Newcastle been on a better run, because he'd heard about it, he thought it was funny. And his agent had said, yeah, if Newcastle are doing all right and there's no, you know, conflict of interest, or, yeah, exactly, he doesn't want it perceived as being...
taking the big one.
Yeah, taking the right. Then he could read the last chapter, but that unfortunately never came to be. But it'd have his seal of approval then, you know.
That's brilliant, mate.
Absolutely brilliant.
Just on that, we are going to let you go. You get a lot of feedback from the impressions you get from the people you do the impressions of. Has anyone ever said, look, I'm not being funny, can you knock that on
the head? The funniest line I've... Well, no one's ever said, please don't do an impression of me.
Yeah.
Dean Saunders found out that I do an impression of him, because Dean's always like, when I played, you had John Hartson, Ian Rush, Mark Hughes, Craig Bellamy, Malcolm Allen, and I was better than all of those because I was brilliant. And the way Dean always is, so, you know, selling himself. And somebody said to him, Dean, do you know Dance does a really good impression of you? And his response was like that. He said, well, he scored 25 goals a season for 5 years in a row. Okay, that's a good comeback. That's a really good comeback.
That is.
I don't think I've ever done anybody's impression to their face. I don't think that would have been very nice.
No.
So I kind of, steered clear of that. Out of respect, really, for the people I was doing. But, Dean Saunders had a very funny comeback.
Yeah, he's very very quick-witted, isn't he? He's very sharp.
Oh, sharp as a tack. Yeah, he doesn't miss anything.
So what's planned for you? But what have you got? What's your next steps?
Next steps, well...
You wrote a book?
I have written a book, which may or may not get taken up by a publisher. And it's a book just about my radio time. I have also started writing stuff about everything that led up my band.
I was going to say, how do I even serialise as from music?
Just do it broad, just doing chronological. I don't think I, you know, that's the way I've written this book about radio. I've just done it purely chronologically. That's the way it worked for me from 1998 through to the present day.
And there's no car that you'd like at the moment that you're going to dedicate a couple of packs to?
I haven't put a very unsubtle request in I should have done that. You've made me think.
Plasma TV. 3 litres.
Exactly.
XC70 Volvo.
Exactly, yeah.
There are other cars.
Too late there. A book is written. Whether that comes to light, it's not down to me. I'd like to record another solo album, because I've got three solo albums that have come out.
I listened to them earlier.
10 to 11 years. Prove You Wrong was 2013. Second Time Around was 2015. And Rule of Three was 2 years ago. And I do have songs that I've written in the same sort of classic rock vein that I love. So I'd like to get around to recording those and get another album made, even though the album as a concept seems less and less important to the music buying public.
Yeah, it's, you know what, I was going to ask you that. How'd you find the dynamic, right? Digital now and...
Well, it's... I mean, you know, Spotify and Apple Music royalty rates are what they are. They're an absolute disgrace. I'm not as reliant on those as you can imagine because of the work that I do. But if I was an artist, you know, and that was my life, and I was relying on streaming rates from these rip-off companies, it would be, you know, I wouldn't be able to buy groceries. It's just, you know,
it's pennies in the pound, isn't it?
Unfortunately, we've got to this point where, you know, and people don't understand why concert tickets are so expensive. Well, work it backwards. You've got to a point where you want all the music that your favourite band or artist records practically for nothing. Where are they going to make their money, an artist or a band? It's through touring and through merchandise. Merchandise is now being cut off by venues who want a 25% cut of anything a band sells on its merchandise. Yes. So that revenue stream's being chopped off to a degree. And that's why concert tickets are so expensive. And that's why I don't agree with dynamic pricing at all. I think it's a disgusting practice. But that's why it's happening. Because these bands, these artists, are getting greedy. The only way they can generate revenue, the makeup for the shortfall with a lack of royalty rates from their music sales, they still get a fee from when it's played on the radio, but not everybody gets played on the radio.
I think the Oasis thing was a bit of pills to swallow more so, wasn't it, because of who they are historically. And I know these divorces
being on for
to pay for, but
well, being on for 6 hours as well was a kind of a guilty when, kind of one. Once you got to the queue, that was...
I mentioned earlier, I'm a Kiss fan, right? And Kiss reunited with their original lineup in 1996. And we were all so excited. And the tickets were £16, £17 or something to go and see that show, the Kiss show.
And yeah, that is a show, isn't it?
It's a show. It's not people walking on with, you know, arms, a pullover and a, you know, pair of slacks and sitting on a bar stool and plucking on an E string. Mm. This is
an experience,
absolutely, a live experience. You know, great music as well. You know, it's not just about the show, it's everything, the whole package. So that was an era where, you know, the concert ticket wasn't a ridiculous expense. But the reason it is now a ridiculous expense is because Radiohead released an album and said, pay what you want for it. U2 had an album released for free through Apple Music that was downloaded to your phone, whether you wanted it or not.
Interesting fact there. My business partner is the only person in the world, I think, that's still got that album on his phone.
It's probably still lurking on mine somewhere, but...
I think it's the only album he's got in there.
Right.
He's not a big music fan.
But that's the... You know, people became conditioned to the idea that music doesn't have to be worth anything. You can watch the video on YouTube. You can stream it on Spotify. And the artist gets 0.001p royalty.
So what was an artist getting money? It was $3.99 for a CD single.
Well, that depends on the record deal that they've signed with the record company. You know, it still wouldn't be huge, but it'd be a damn sight more than what they're getting now. The other problem you had was in the 90s, you had artists like Mariah Carey and Robbie Williams signing these huge contracts with major record companies. Huge. And, of course, they kept all the money, and the money wasn't more evenly distributed,
right,
you know, to up-and-coming artists. And the record companies didn't see the streaming thing coming till it was too late. There was the Napster thing. Napster was the first sort of file sharing thing that ever came out. Metallica were the band that tried to stop it and said that we can see where this is going. Metallica were almost made as pariahs for doing what they did and saying, you have to stop this because we can see what happens in the future and how royalty rates get diminished. And it's only now that Metallica are getting, well, actually they were right, you know, because Lars Ulrich can be seen as a bit of a figure of fun, the Metallica drummer, you know. Mm. But he and his bandmates were right. Napster and file sharing was a logical extension of... Do you remember those adverts you used to get in your vinyl records? Home taping is killing music and it's illegal. There was a skull and a crossbones in a cassette thing. I mean, we used to
play the piracy on the beginning of
VRD. Yeah, And we...
You wouldn't steal a car.
Yeah. So you don't steal a movie or... You know,
yeah.
And somebody even told me, even if you bought a vinyl album and taped it for the car, that was illegal. So even if you just had a cassette of an album you loved and you didn't have a vinyl record player in your car... Mm. No. You're supposed to buy the cassette version. Don't you just make your own copy of it and play it in your car? That's illegal. I don't know whether that's true, but that's what I was led to believe. So it was already there, but it wasn't as proliferated as much as it became with the file share, because it was so much easier to file share.
Right. I think we can... It's time for us to let you go. Talk to you all day, honestly. Thank you ever so much for your time today.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been lovely being here. It's lovely being here. Lovely seeing you guys.
Yeah.
And thank you for taking an interest in a boring old Barmy Brummie.
Thank you.
Cheers.